This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Yes, I am a woman, and my eyes are squarely centered on Black Liberation, says Latasha Brown, co-founder of Black Voters Matter, who'll talk about the upcoming race to elect Democratic challengers Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff, and for Black empowerment. Latasha Brown, talk about what you think was the critical element taking Georgia, a traditionally red state, and swinging it for President-elect Biden.
More people voted. This has been my mantra for the last 20 years. The South isn't red, it's just been underinvested. So that there needed to be more resources to invest the organized power. There are more people that live in these southern states that are more in alignment with the values that I believe than those who want to hold on to a past that I think is fading. In the last 10 years, the level, the intensity of the voter suppression, it was so red, it was so solid, we wouldn't see the kind of voter suppression that we've seen in Georgia. The reason why we've seen the voter suppression, particularly directed at communities of color, is because the demographics are shifting. There is a progressive voice in the South that is, we've been organizing ourselves and seeks to rise up. This frame of the South being red in the political spectrum is because in every election cycle, you have these Republican candidates that win in the federal election. But I can also point to how there's been a lack of investment in the political infrastructure on those voters of color when you compare that to the kind of investment that we've seen in the money that's come down for on the Republican side. And so on some level, I think that there's three things that led the difference in this particular election. I think one is we have the numbers. I do think that there are more people that I think are more aligned with the vision around moving forward than going backwards. Secondly, you can have those people, but it doesn't make a difference if you can't move them. Who wins the election? Who is able to garner the most votes? What I know happened this time is that there's been 10 years of deep organizing led by groups that were indigenous groups in community to really be able to build power. I often talk about the elements were already there. It's just a matter of how they're directed and how they're concentrated and how they're focused. And so in the South, we're here. You look at the diversity of the South. If you look at the growth of the South, if you look at Atlanta and Houston and New Orleans, places that over the last few years have had an explosion in their population growth. In this last election cycle, you also see this infrastructure that is literally being developed to organize this new demographics. And then the third thing is there was a president that was in office that was just absolutely horrible on so many different levels. Georgia was one of the places that was devastated by COVID-19, and we had a lack of leadership from the federal level down to the state level. Our governor was one of the governors that was like the first to jump out and say he wanted to open the state back up, that he was in denial. He like he didn't know that the virus was airborne. He aligned himself into Trump, right, and literally in a state where at one point in Albany, Georgia, Daugherty County, which is a part of Southwest Georgia, the third highest number of COVID deaths in the world was in that little place in Georgia. That in April, 80% of all hospitalizations related to COVID-19 were African Americans when we're only 30% of the population. I think what we saw is an absolute lack of leadership. People were able to organize around these issues. There are hospitals closing in the state of Georgia right now. There are hospitals, two hospitals closed in the last 90 days in the state of Georgia during a pandemic, right, because of the refusal of the Republicans to actually expand. Now, as we're looking at the Senate race, you've got two senators who instead of looking out for the interests of the people of the state, have been looking out for their own self-interest in terms of inside trading. So I think what happened in Georgia is this combination of organizations that have been organizing and building power with community for the last decade, two, that we're in this particular kind of environment, this political environment, that I think people were paying attention more that normally have not been paying attention. And I think third, I think we've got some critical issues. 4 million people in the state of Georgia have applied for unemployment. That's a significant number for our state. We see a rise in COVID-19 cases. That's significant. And so I just think that all of those elements together really worked for a space that people just said enough is enough.
Looking at North Carolina, where you have the tremendous powerhouse efforts of Reverend Barber, at Mississippi, where you have Cooperation Jackson, how come those nuts weren't cracked? What do you think the difference was between the swing in Georgia and states like North Carolina and Mississippi, who also had some formative grassroots boots on the ground organizing and definitely represent the Browning of America?
I think one, timing. As an organizer in the movement, I've always recognized there's a sequence in timing. There's other elements that come into play and impact the outcome. And so what I think happened in North Carolina, it was they focused on North Carolina as a state, so much so that when you look at the voter suppression that had happened in that state, when you look at the fight around from gerrymandering, where even the court said the Republicans had done it with surgical precision to prevent African Americans from voting, I think that in many ways that North Carolina was considered a swing state at much greater scale than Georgia was. Georgia has been, for the 28 years, a solid red in the presidential election, has been the Republicans have run. And so I think that in North Carolina, I think there's been a head start. I think there was a lot of focus and attention on that. At the level of work, Reverend Barber is building an amazing national movement, which they were very effective this election cycle. The challenge, I think, what we do sometimes around elections is that we judge the strength of the movement by the outcome of the election. And I think that we have to look at expanded ways of winning. For example, in 2018 in Georgia, people could have seen 2018, you know, in the Stacey Abrams race, where there was a lot of documented voter suppression, that we lost that race. And folks could have said, well, we lost that race. They go back to whatever they were doing prior to the race. We saw that, wait a minute, like if they went through these extraordinary measures to steal this election, that we had up until this past election, we had the largest number of Democratic voters to come out in that election. What is possible? Let's keep going. So I think that we had to build on the success of what we were doing and continue. And when the right opportunity in the right conditions came about, we were able to take advantage of that. In North Carolina, I actually anticipate that's going to happen. I think what you're going to see, I mean, and we're seeing glimpses of it, but we're also seeing major resistance as well. Alabama is a prime example. In 2017, for that Senate seat, Republican, for those 2 years, literally is an indicator that something is changing in a state like Alabama, where 75% of the voters in that state vote consistently Republican. So I think it's a matter of timing. We're in those places, timing around where the movement was at the intersection of what the political landscape was looking like in terms of where the opportunities, I think that they led to a particular kind of outcome. You know, when I look at Mississippi, we had the opportunity to elect a African-American as a U.S. senator. What you would note is that he garnered more votes than anybody has since 1972. So while he did not actually win the seat, there were more people that participated. And that's kind of like the same trajectory that we saw in 2018. More people participated, and now we've increased it. And as we continue to increase it, things will change and transform. So I think the difference in those states, some of it is numbers. You're having a large metro in Georgia that is heavily African American. The Atlanta metro area, I think, played a significant role in it, but also I think what we saw is some deep organizing throughout the Georgia Black Belt as well. So I just think that some of the conditions were a little bit different, but I also don't, I think we have to be very careful that we're not judging those states or that work in those states because they did not turn in the presidential election. If you look at some of those seats, including South Carolina, if you look at some of the down ballot, what you will see is there were some victories in those areas. If you look at numbers of voters in certain areas, I think you will see that there was a rise. And so I think we just have to be mindful around not comparing apples to oranges, because on one hand, yes, in the presidential election, they did not flip. But I also think that there were other victories in those states, particularly around down ballot.
I wonder if you might detail in greater detail the strategy that your organization, the Black Voters Matter Victory Fund, has in Georgia, and also the place of a lawsuit that you're co-sponsoring with regard to the voter suppression there?
We are in litigation. There were almost 200,000 voters purged from the voting list in Georgia in October of 2019. We have the evidence that they never should have been dropped from the voting rolls. We had a team of experts and worked with investigative journalist Greg Callas, and a team of experts that do data lists that where they look at the data. They do data hygiene for major companies, huge Fortune 100 companies, and they were a part of the team to really be able to help us to look at the list, and almost 200,000 people on that list, 198,000 people on that list, they realized that there was really no justification of why they were dropped from the list. And so we reached out to the Secretary of State to figure out how could the list be so off. 200,000 was a lot of people. Like, where did they get the list? And then what was discovered in the process, actually in an interview with CNN, that the office did with the CNN, is that the Voting Rights Act requires that you have to have a licensee vendor that actually does data hygiene to really be that you work with before to make sure that the list is a valid list, and they didn't use that, which means that technically they did not even meet the basic requirements of the Voting Rights Act. And so we are suing the state of Georgia, asking them to immediately restore the 198,000 people that were wrongly taken off the voting rolls that we feel never should have been taken off in the first place. But in light of the fact that they didn't even meet the basic requirement of the Voting Rights Act in getting a licensee to make sure that the list, the hygiene and the list was actually a good list, that we're asking that they're restored immediately. And so we're in litigation about that currently right now in the state of Georgia, and we're one of the plaintiffs. As it relates to our work in Black Voters Matter Fund and Black Voters Matter Capacity Building Institute, we are a power-building organization. We never say that we're an electoral organization because we're not. What is important is that the electoral process is a part of a power-building strategy, but it's not the strategy. And so our work is really focused on how do we strengthen the capacity of Black-led groups throughout the country. We're focusing right now our work in 11 states. Vast majority are in the South, and that's quite frankly because the majority of Black people live in the South. In our work, what we know is that in every community there is an existing infrastructure. Some are in some communities it's stronger than others. And that part of our role would be that we would actually work with those frontline organizations that are always responding to the needs of that community, that are always responding to seeing themselves in a place of helping to build power, and that what we would do is actually be able to bring resources to them, that we would actually be able to bring tools to them from everything from phone banking to text banking to data analysis, also even from lifting up stories and really being able to amplify their work and amplify their stories. And so even this last election cycle, we were able to fund over 600 Black-led community grassroots groups, meaning we actually committed and put dollars directly into those groups to the work that they were doing, of everything from $5,000 up to over $300,000 to those organizations to do work on the ground, because we felt they're indigenous to those communities. They know those communities, and it's a larger power building strategy. We also work as a coordinated campaign in many ways, where our campaign is Black Voters Matter. Our candidate is Building Black Power. A lot of times around elections, you're depending on the support from either a political party or a political candidate. What we thought was very important is that we build independent Black political power so that Black people are engaged in a process that we can determine collectively around what agenda we want. We can collectively determine and put pressure on any candidate or electors that are in office, be they Democrat or Republican, but that there would be a level of independence, could actually focus on what our agenda is, and then be able to work with those that are aligned with our agenda to move things forward.
The eyes of the country are on the battle for the Senate. They are focused on Georgia. Where does the effort to defeat David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler fit into the agenda?
We have been very adamant that Loeffler and Perdue are just not good for Georgia, right? And we're able to, like, really, through our Black Voters Matter Fund, really focus on those and not, that is not good for Georgia for a number of reasons. Their lack of leadership that they've demonstrated so far, how they have really been complicit in what the governor has done, and the lack of leadership around COVID-19, but also in their kowtowing to the Trump campaign. Right. And then just in general, they just have not been effective at all. And so we are actually very supportive of the candidacy of Ossoff and Warnock, which are the Democratic nominees, because we feel like they will be more in alignment with our agenda around making health care a major issue for our state. We are one of the states that refused to expand ACA. And as there's been closures of hospitals in the middle of a pandemic, we're closing hospitals in rural areas. There are some people that are traveling 100 miles to get to a hospital. That is just unacceptable. So part of what we have been doing is really being able to keep what we think is important, the issues at the forefront, and ask people to support those candidates that align themselves with our issues. And so in this race, it happens to be Reverend Warnock and Ossoff. Fundamentally, we've got to literally make a shift. You know, I know that the country is looking at this race around the implications of these two seats as it relates to who controls the Senate. And yes, that is critical. But what is really critical is we can't get lost in just in the national framing that who has to live with these senators and who we need, right, that we've got problems in Georgia ourselves. When we're looking at the fact that 80% of Black businesses did not get any resources around the stimulus package, hundreds of Black businesses have closed for COVID-19 and not received any support, the devastated numbers of Black folk who have been impacted by COVID-19. When we're looking at the police sanctioned murder of Ahmaud Arbery, and nothing would have been done about that had not the people in that community rose up. And then I just want to do a shout out for them, because of that, because they organized, they actually replaced that DA who had refused to move on that until under some pressure. And that DA is now out of office and replaced by someone who is aligned to, with the folks in that community who organized around that. And so that when we're talking about this election, while there is a national implication of this, we can't lose sight that the folks in Georgia are going to have to make a decision about not just what's good for the country, but what is good for people in Georgia. And the truth of the matter is changing those two seats could have a dramatic impact, right, not just on the nation, but literally on the resources that come to the state, on the kind of policy that impact the people that live in the state.
In terms of an empowerment agenda, there has been a backlash against Black Lives Matter, including President Obama reappeared and is a critic of the slogan and effort to defund the police. I'm just interested in how you feel that your agenda of empowerment doesn't get lost in the furor around the electoral process, with the Democratic Party placing major emphasis and resources and untold amounts of money into the state of Georgia.
Part of what we're tired of is just being a pawn to a political party interest and not necessarily see our agenda go forward. And so what I do think that there's a different ball game, political landscape, is because the depth of relationships that organizations like mine, New Georgia Project, and the People's Coalition on Georgia, People's Coalition, there's several other organizations that we, over the last 10 years, have been building relationships with communities that are on the ground. That one of my critiques of the election cycle is that what we would see is we would see these cycles, which I call it like the vicious cycle, that you would only see the political parties 3 weeks. 3 weeks out before the election, it's like the round the Negroes up. Let's just round you up, and then, you know, and it's kind of like when you think about even in our own relationships, who will you listen to? The person that just comes around when they want something from you, or the people who have been working with you and building relationships? And so I'm saying that because I think we're on the same team in terms of we have the same goal. Let me say that. We have the same goal of moving things forward. I disagree with President Obama around his messaging. I think that there's a segment of the Democratic Party that is actually uncomfortable with that. But I actually think that the organizers, that I applaud the young organizers that actually created it, made everybody feel uncomfortable. That is the point. I have not seen in the last 10 years, not, I haven't even seen, even during his administration, how I'm going to play nice, how that has yielded anything around that issue. That, yes, if we're just nice and talk about let's get the police to actually, let's create resources and let's reallocate resources. When did that work? Years. Folks have been asking for that for years. You know, and so that at the end of the day, how has that worked? That didn't work. But what we do know is since these young organizers have launched the Defund the Police, while it has been very controversial in a sense, part of what has happened, we've also seen movement. We've seen where $120 million of the budget in San Francisco has been redirected. We've seen that happen throughout places all over the country. So to the extent that we're talking about the effectiveness, is it controversial? Absolutely. Does it make some people feel uncomfortable? Absolutely. But I also can say as an organizer, oftentimes when I've seen the biggest gains of minorities in this country, the biggest gains from the African-American community, we have to make people feel uncomfortable to take us seriously. And so I think that that's a tactical strategy, and I know there are people who have all kinds of different beliefs around the side of the spectrum. But the question for me is, who is it making uncomfortable, right? And why is it making them uncomfortable, right? It's because part of the reason why I think it's making them, some people uncomfortable, because there's not a real conversation underneath that that has been the reallocation of resources. That's not what we've seen. What we've seen in the last few decades, we've actually seen those police budgets grow. So now all of a sudden we're supposed to believe there's enough effort and goodwill that we're talking about cutting down budgets. No, I applaud those young folks for pushing all of us to deal with what it is that we don't want to deal with. And oftentimes that requires us being pushed in the space to be uncomfortable. The second thing, though, the best way that you hold folks accountable is you out-organize them. You either have to have a carrot or a stick, or both. Good organizing works equally on everybody. If you put good organizing, you can put a pressure point of those in power. You can put a pressure point on candidates. You can put pressure point on political parties. And so I think that part of our response to this is just to keep doing the work and organize, educate, and build power with our people.
Trump is coming down to Georgia to try to get out the vote, or maybe he's just doing it for his own purposes. Do you think that helps or hurts the Republican Party in Georgia?
I actually think it's going to hurt the party. You know, there are a couple of things we know about Trump. The first thing we know about Trump is Trump is about Trump. Then I think that he doesn't really care whether it helps or hurts them. I think that is a part of his ongoing narrative around somehow this election was taken from him, although he knows the truth around it. And so I think that he's just going to use Georgia as a backdrop to continue this facade and continue to build himself and his base. And I certainly think that that is going to work against the party. On the other hand, I do think that there's an element of what Trump has been effective at doing that certainly lives in the state of Georgia, and that is racism. That what I know for sure, he has weaponized and continued to use this issue around race, right, to literally be able to, as an organizing tool for white America. And what we have seen, unfortunately, because white America refuses to deal with structural racism on the left and the right, that to refuse to really address it, I do think that there's unfortunately a level of effectiveness, right, when those use a rallying cry around structural racism in a state that black voters have been applauded, in a state that black voters showed up and showed out, in a state where you saw Asian voters and the Latinx and LGBTQ, African Americans, all those groups that the Republicans have exploited around trying to otherize. I do believe that he will have that message. And unfortunately, I do think that in some ways will actually feed part of the process. So I think overall, him coming down is not a big help. I don't think that even the party is welcoming him down. I don't think anybody asked him to come down.
So the work that remains to be done to weed out white supremacy, what is it that is the message there and the work that you see in terms of the white community? What is the message to them and the admonition around a white supremacy that is fundamental towards working towards the empowerment of the African-American community?
I think white America has not accepted that white supremacy is bad for us all. In the state of Georgia, where we saw massive voter suppression of the black community, some of us have been doing this work, have been screaming that for years. And many progressives have ridden off the South, as long as that was happening to black voters, but not really seeing it as it happening to themselves. And so now, as we see in many ways, which I think is really poetic, that the fate of how we go forward, it's not going to be based on how blue and how progressive California is or how progressive as New York is. It is all at this moment we find ourselves that those same black communities that have been dealing with voter suppression and been screaming voter suppression for the last 10 years are now the black voters that we're expecting to try to show up. And so I'm hoping that this is a reflective moment around how we are interconnected. Whenever you allow the oppression of another person and not really recognize that the oppression of them also empowers those that oppress, right, to really be able to get in the space of holding power that will fundamentally oppress you, right? And so if Trump hasn't taught us anything, you know, if some of the discomfort that I think the progressive whites have been feeling the last 4 years out of Trump, Trump is not new for us. We deal with Trump every day. And it, like, literally, that's what we've been dealing with year after year after year. That the bottom line, we have been saying this, that when you are suppressing black voters, it weakens the entire system for all of us. So I hope that this is a reflective moment for white America. We need to really recognize how anytime justice is threatened for one, it is threatened for us all. And so I'm hoping that in this moment, we really recommit ourselves around recognizing that racism and sexism and homophobia, that any form of oppression, but it literally creates a space for injustice in many, many other areas to expand and exist, and that affects us all.
As we watch closely the January 5th runoff elections against David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler for John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock, it is the game on the ground that people like Latosha Brown, co-founder of Black Voters Matter, have been working around to show us the promise and hopefully the realization towards democratization and empowerment of the communities of poor, the communities of African Americans in the South. And I can't thank you enough, and I just have one regret, and that is we don't get a chance to talk about what a great jazz singer you have been as well.
Well, you also have me there.
You are, and
I've got to get through this election, but I'm actually releasing an album this year, so I would love to come back and we can talk about some fun stuff.
You got it.
Thank you so much
for educating us, Latosha
thank
Brown.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Building Bridges, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Stay strong and stay well.